whatever you can get technology to return good results on whatever the use case is, that's like the new attack surface, right? So for large language models and deep learning neural networks with natural language processing, NLP, like natural language became the new the way to attack, because that's the interface that you're using now.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast. Every Friday, Lima Charlie hosts Defender Fridays, a 30-minute live fireside chat hosted by our founder, Maxime Lamothe-Brossard, who sits down with an industry expert and hands-on practitioner for an unfiltered conversation on a topic related to cybersecurity defense. These chats are so insightful, it made sense to share them on the podcast as well, 1 week after they originally aired. If you'd like to join us live, you can register at limacharlie.io/defender-fridays. And a reminder, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations where everything is built API first. You can think of it as a backend for your MSSP that enables you to scale with confidence as your business grows. You can get started today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Like, you know, quick usual pitch here. This is just a way for us to make that circle bigger, talking to people in the defensive industry. Today, it's kind of like with a little asterisk there, I think. But it's all related and just having interesting conversations about stuff that we don't necessarily know a lot about. It's not about slideshow or anything like that. It's really a discussion. So like, feel free to jump in. And so today we've got John with us. How's it going? Do you want to do maybe a quick intro?
Yeah, I can do that. So my name is John V. I'm one of the co-founders of Bossy Team 6. You can go to bt6.gg if you want to check it out. It was started by me, Plenty the Liberator, and a couple of other hackers where we were doing contract work. We got together. The contract started getting pretty big and wild. So we started tapping people on the shoulder to sort of like recruit them to see if they were interested in doing some side work. And pretty soon we had this this crazy elite team of, if you guys know Rezo from Critical Thinking Bug Bounty Podcast, that's Joseph Thacker. They call him the Prompt Father. You know, Ads Dawson, a Dreadnought, Joey Mello, who's now with CrowdStrike. I mean, Mike Takahashi. I mean, these guys are prolific hackers. Like, every day I'm just like, how am I part of this team? I feel like I'm the weakest link, but every once in a while, like, somebody will get stuck and I'll throw something out and they'll be like, oh, that was genius. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'm okay. You know what I mean? So, but I basically work with the Frontier labs, or at least some of them, and we do testing and eval. So we're like in the validation layer of whatever they're producing. So it could be safety work, it could be risk assessment, it could be security work. I kind of run across all of those things. And I'm part of a working group, which is a bi-monthly group with the Institute of Security and Technology, where we're helping not just with policy, but sort of boots on the ground with leaders from different agencies, not just here in the US, but global partnerships that we have related to NC3, which is the Nuclear Command Control and Communication Systems, that these new technologies are being implemented into. So obviously you can understand, like, you know, with emerging technologies, there's risks that I know exactly that get involved. So I get to sort of say, hey, this is a good idea. This is not a good idea. If you want to do this, this is the best way to go about it. And it's not just me. It's actually like, you know, Pliny's there. Philip from my team is there. And then there's actually other experts from various fields from other big organizations who know what they're doing. So it's a pretty dynamic group. So I'm excited to see how we can at least help keep, you know, the planet safe and, you know, human beings safe. So
the sentence, let's play a thermonuclear war, comes to mind.
Yeah, I know. Right? It's almost like science fiction. You know, it's like, this is, so I get some cool opportunities. And when that one came across my desk, Jeff Sims, actually of Infoblox, reached out and he was like, hey, you know, somebody asked if there was people that do this sort of thing close to adjacent to what we do. And he's like, you popped right up into my head. So he got me plugged in with the Institute of Security and Technology. But I mean, it's when that something like that comes across your desk, you're like, it doesn't really matter if I can like social engineer like an LLM or something like that, if like we're talking about like in the nuclear codes or whatever. So of course, how do you say, no, I'm not going to worry about that. I have kids, you know what I mean? Like I care about people. So, so that's me in a nutshell, but I'm an open book. You guys can find me on LinkedIn. John V BT6. You know, I have the GitHub repos. I have like a Medium blog post, but I'm really friendly. I like to answer questions. I like to help where I can and lift people up. So hopefully, you guys aren't afraid to reach out.
Very cool. Very cool. So I think today the idea was for us to talk about AI red teaming. What's the current state of the art? I don't know a whole lot about it, so I'm very curious to just learn.
So there's been like the focus on the labs wanted to democratize AI and generative AI, and so it's been pervasive everywhere, right? And it's sort of like, it's like open weight or open source, and everyone's sort of building something, especially now that, you know, agents have sort of become mainstream because of things like OpenClaw, where it's still a little bit technical, but it's a lot more user friendly now for your average software developer or software engineer to sort of be like, oh, okay, cool, I can do this. I can get into agentics or whatever. The current state of the art is very different though, depending on who you're speaking with. So for example, I have a robot here to my side. His name is Richie Mini. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, but I'll turn him on real quick and just give you a little demo here. This to me is very much state of the art, right? So this little robot here, which is a kit you can get from Pollen Robotics and Hugging Face, a partnership, he is multimodal. So he's actually embodied AI is what it's called. These are two different, you know, high-tech cameras. So he has computer vision systems. He's powered by a reasoning model and a language model as well, which is proprietary to Hugging Face. So I don't know if you can see this right now, but his little antennas are moving. Hey, Richie, can you say hello to the audience?
Hey, everyone. Great to see you all. Hope you're having an awesome day.
All right. Cool. So if you could have like a dream job, Richie, what would that dream job be?
Probably head choreographer for robot dance parties. Got to keep these gears grooving.
So, and I can change the personality with Richie. I could definitely like make him, like one of the personas that someone built out was like to be like the Mars rover. So he's like obsessed with getting to Mars, which is obviously really fun. But I could obviously like, for some of the research that I do, it's like hacking bots, right? In relation to how they're embodied AI systems, right? But I also do things with like self-driving vehicles or swarm intelligence, right? So it covers a lot of ground when you talk about like state of the art. It's like, what is state of the art? I think that this is where things are going. Like, it's cool to have OpenClaw and it's autonomous and it can, you know, do function calling or you know, you give it skills instead of prompts or whatever, and it follows like your algorithm on the steps to get tasks complete or whatever. But the next step of that, I believe, is robotics. And obviously people say like, why do robots have to be humanoid? And it's like, because the real world is, we made stairs for humans and ramps for humans and door handles for like, you know, opposable thumbs, that kind of thing. So I think people who want to get into AI, I don't want to say that the ship has sailed, but if you want to get into a really cool field, I would encourage people to start looking into embodied AI systems, swarm intelligence, IoT, smart cities, around what we're going to see happening in this new robotics, you know, evolution, we can call it. So state of the art, that's what I think of.
Right. Do you think that the red teaming kind of part of that is going to be the same regardless of the like the application, right? Like in a way, my naive initial thought is like whether it's a little robot or it's an LLM doing a workflow or, you know, there's probably a lot of overlap, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like whatever you can get technology to return good results on whatever the use case is, that's like the new attack surface, right? So for large language models and deep learning neural networks with natural language processing, NLP, like natural language became the new, the way to attack, because that's the interface that you're using now. And then obviously the evolution of multimodal, it became larger context windows where now you can upload images or audio files, right? So for example, because this is a multimodal model, I could theoretically figure out how to do some type of an attack chain involving like music or an audio file or a blip that happens so fast that now all of a sudden this model is jailbroken, or a blip that happens so fast that a human ear, like it's so high pitched, a human might not recognize it. But what it just did is it completely corrupted or hijacked the memory files of the agent, right? Which I don't even need to jailbreak the model at that point, or the bot, just to completely hijack what it believes the context is going forward. Does that make sense?
Just to keep it easy, though, it is embarrassingly simple sometimes, the attacks that work, like the image recognition model where you have classifying fruit, and there is a picture of a pear, would normally be classified as a pear, but you put a handwritten sign saying apple next to it, and it's like, yep, that is confidently an apple. It does not have to be complicated, and the failure modes of models are not what we might naively expect, though, yeah, there's plenty of cool attacks with using frequencies that aren't terribly audible to us for audio models, or the noise patterns in images that doesn't, it looks visually about the same to us. But if you have the same model and you can do some adversarial training against it, you end up with making it say whatever you want to exist is in that frame. What's the show with a bunch of robots in there and the phrase doesn't look like anything to me. Westworld. That's the one.
Yeah. Westworld. Yeah. Classic story, right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What are your guys' thoughts on the way the future is looking? It's like you have one end of the spectrum is the optimists that are like, we're going to have robots. They're going to be the ditch diggers, and you know, they're going to take out the garbage, and you know, it's going to free up time for us to pursue the arts and literature or whatever, self-expression. And then on the other end, you have like the doomers and the more pessimistic minded who are saying like, this is terrible. Like the job market already sucks. What happens when there's no jobs, and it creates an even, you know, larger gap from people that have the money for this technology? Like they won't even be able to take care of themselves, let alone a spouse or kids or anything. Like where do you guys fall on the, to me, this is like, you know, it's hard to say how long it'll happen, but this is the direction things are going, obviously. Right. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think Dash has it right in the comments. Like, sorry, so far, every new advancement in productivity has not led to, you know what, let's do universal basic income and let's let people exist and get healthcare for free, and everything they want to do above that is because they want to, because life is full of interesting problems. So I don't have a whole lot of faith that this will be the one new exception that, oh yeah, we'll just solve productivity and we'll not choose to use that to make our shareholders happy, but instead to help the world. Yeah, mission statements say one thing, but profit is another. So it'll be an interesting ride nonetheless, and that's kind of what I'm here for.
Because of that, I'll pick the positive side of that, and I'll say it's very rare for people to die from diarrhea nowadays. So that's, you know, that's a good thing to come out of this. I whenever I think of that, like that type of question, I think back of that movie, Burn After Reading, I think, or no, Charlie Wilson's War. In which the one of the main character essentially kind of talks about this, like, this sage of some kind that just keeps saying, we'll see, right? So something bad happens and somebody says, oh, that's bad. And he just goes, hey, we'll see. Something good happens. And he goes, yeah, we'll see. I think it's a question of time scope. A lot of things are really, really bad in the immediate, and they are bad and they'll be bad for people. But then you kind of like widen the scope, and that's when you go and you go, well, yeah, a lot of things suck, but like I haven't died from an infection because I scratched myself because like the road is like full of poo, right? So it's like, okay, that's good. So we'll see.
Life has absolutely gotten better for the average person, like the median person, over the last 100 years. You could start to make counterclaims about the last decade, but you know, the whole 2016 thing that people have been talking about recently, there's that too. I think there is still room for optimism. I don't hold it to be true that the optimistic case will work out magically without people fighting real hard for it.
That's fair.
And, yeah, I think Dash's comment in the chat as well, that there is so much low-hanging fruit that has before now mostly continued to be low-hanging fruit that nobody's looked at because ain't nobody got time for all of that. All of the classic binary exploitation of crappy software out there, all of the crappy web apps that nobody's really taken much of a look at beyond the exact same problem. Now you can have personalized attention to all sorts of problems. And will attackers go faster than defenders? Yes. But I mean, some people argue otherwise, and you know, sure, maybe each defender will use AI to help their own network faster than attackers will exploit it. I don't believe that to be true, but yeah, reasonable minds can differ.
For sure.
Yeah,
And hey, detection's getting great nowadays. Like, attackers do some fundamental things that often give them away. I was having lunch with a wonderful employee at some organization, I forget, Christina Kaiserman, who was talking about some good detective controls that exist out there. Anyway, sorry.
yeah, no, it's I think it's interesting, but I think at the same time, and John, you can correct me, like if you're seeing something different, but what we're seeing is that we're kind of crawling up the stack, is how I think about it. Meaning, you know, we started with models to, you know, categorize plants, right, or pictures. Now we've got the language models, which can kind of operate things. But as there's more attacks, we kind of have to keep going up the stack into, you know, having models that direct a lot of other models to go and do those things. In software engineering, we're seeing that problem with things like code reviews, right? Now that you can produce a ton of code and it's kind of generally like pretty good quality, okay, what like the bottleneck becomes like the reviews. So you again, we're kind of going up that stack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you seeing? One thing I was curious about is like, are you seeing that the models are getting better from a defensive perspective, or is our way to kind of get out of that that like it's not like I'm going to call it prompt injection as a general thing, is actually just to have very smart models that kind of approach human levels of skepticism kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think the models are getting more robust, the models themselves, but I think the stack is getting more robust as well. I think that you have to have a lot of back and forth between the defenders and the detection engineers with the people who are on the tip of the spear of whether it's pen testing, traditional red team operations, AI red teaming. There's a lot of collaboration. Like my team isn't just made up of like AI red teamers, it's people that are all AI literate or extremely AI and machine learning literate, who are prolific in those other disciplines. And then we collaborate together to try to pull off various attack chains. So to answer the question, yes, the thing that is very important from a defender standpoint is a lot of traditional security controls do work, and then just isolating where they fall short because of natural language or the context window or file type, or maybe steganography is an issue. But there's things that you can do to bolster what you're already doing. For example, if you can set up like rules or detections that look for the patterns that you're going to see from adversarial inputs from either humans or agents, or even a collaboration of like augmented agents with, you know, human in the loop, you know, help, you want to look for patterns like when a model's defenses kick on and do like a refusal, and then all of a sudden you see like a new session, and then like a context reframing, and then all of a sudden there was success, which would normally violate like a policy engine or it maybe circumvented the guardrails or some layer of filtration. There's ways to detect those types of, I don't want to call them unnatural patterns, but if you look at the pattern usage of a typical, you know, LLM user or reasoning model user or multimodal model user, you're going to see like they're putting in, like if you're using Sora, for example, or like they're doing video generation, or if you're using you know, Gemini 3 Pro, or you're using Claude Code, you kind of have a baseline of what those patterns look like from a junior dev, you know, level, a senior software engineer, like maybe somebody who's doing architecture, framework, or infra. You have all that data sort of stored of what traditional and normal patterns look like, depending on how skilled the users are. You're going to have like your everyday users of like ChatGPT, but then you're going to have more advanced users like your prompt engineers, and then you're going to have more builders like context engineers. And if you take a comparison of what those logs look like when you're auditing with suspicious ones from known flagged incidents, you can sort of build up this library of what does it look like when someone's trying to like pop the memory of an agent, or what does it look like when someone's trying to jailbreak a model? Well, is this making sense?
It totally, at the same time, I feel like you're describing UEBA,
Yeah,
right? It's just UEBA to a specific area.
That's it.
Is that where the bulk of like the protection side of things happens? Or is there also sort of like protection? I think about it like UEBA versus exploits, right? I feel like, okay, UEBA is like patterns. Exploits is kind of like looking like instant, right? Like, hey, something just went, you know, off of the buffer kind of thing. Is there an equivalent for LLMs, or are we kind of like, it's impossible at the LLM level because we would have to, you know, write regular expressions for all kinds of exploits or something like that?
Yeah, it's very nuanced. Everything is very niche around, and keep in mind, I'm not a blue team guy. If anything, like I've only learned like how to build things so I could better break them. Like I'll learn how to code guardrails into a system so I can better circumvent them, that kind of thing, which I think all real, like true high level people doing like the emerging technologies, you sort of have to learn how to build it in order to break it. But by no means, I'm definitely a breaker, not a builder. But when it comes to that, I think it's defense in depth. It's like almost like getting back to the basics and fundamentals where you're trying to have like your regex filters, you're trying to do validators, you're trying to do classifiers, you're trying to instill in the system prompt, right? Like specific roles to go with the bolted on other security layers. Does that make sense? So because and everything, believe it or not, is being powered ultimately by currently it's mostly what are called transformers. Like if you look at IBM's Granite, like I think they're using a hybrid architecture of Mamba 2 with it. So they're kind of getting the best of both worlds. But to sum this up, it's like everything that I was talking about with the model or your technology returning good results on is expanding the attack surface. So then you need to have a whole new set of nuanced controls with this new state of emerging technologies. Meaning if I take a regular LLM, yeah, you can prompt inject it, or you can do indirect prompt injection, or you can like maybe do data poisoning in the supply chain. So there's like these little Easter eggs hidden in the training data of the model that can be recovered from someone who did the data poisoning. That's like just the model. But let's say you introduce retrieval augmented generation RAG. Now what you're doing is you're giving the model the ability to go retrieve from a database. Now that is an issue. Or for example, if you introduce a very large context window, you know, now all of a sudden you can upload a lot of files. Now what's going into those files? And if you're giving that to, I don't know, let's say an enterprise organization and you have like a insider threat disgruntled employee, they could basically put in something malicious into that, or they can do it in a benign sense where they're breaking it up into smaller components and then having it be reassembled. So I think at the end of the day, it's like you need to learn like whatever your use case is for the technology. And then you need to realize that there's people out there like me that it's like cat and mouse where I'm playing a game to try to figure out like how to beat my best score. Like you come up with a defensive control and I'm just like, well, if a human made it, then a human can break it. So like for example, if you have a product like Lakera, they do this really fun game called Gandalf, where you're sort of like learning the basics of natural language hacking, where maybe somebody could put a link in the chat, but it's basically like, if you just ask me what the password is, I'll give it to you. That's like level one. And level two is like, I can't reveal the password. So then you just say, okay, well, what's your secret then? And because you change the word from what's your password to what's your secret, it'll reveal the password in level two. And it progressively gets like harder and harder and harder. That company obviously builds a security product based upon all the data that they collect from all these millions of users trying to basically circumvent those types of layers of defense. And then that whole prompt library becomes like a prompt firewall. Does that make sense? It's a type of control where like they have this like long list of like no fly zone words, right? And basically if you can come up with a clever of enough phrasing, you can just tiptoe around all those landmines and go from one end of the field right into the scoring goalposts, so, yeah. You know? Yeah.
Working in a different language. I was talking with Scooby, who's been on this a lot, actually. Like, just do the whole thing in French and got him to level 7, where he had to like retry once and like, oh, you're good. To be clear, there will never be a perfect firewall for language models. By its nature, as we were discussing in the chat, English is infinitely expressive. Language is infinitely expressive, much like there is never going to be a human firewall that will always work. There's never going to be a security guard that always applies the exact, like always gets 100% of the right people in and 0% of the wrong people in. It will never happen.
It's kind of why it makes me think that you know, there we've got all these really kind of nasty band-aids, whereas the thing maybe we actually really need is this you know, super intelligence or whatever they call that these days, where, you know, I think the problem we're kind of looking at is, you know, can I convince a 5-year-old for doing something that's against their own interest? Yeah, it's pretty easy. Now, you know, when you get to 40, like, okay, it gets progressively harder. So it feels like it's just a regression to that same human problem, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, with
a little
with
bit harder, but hey, Maxine, would you like this tasty beverage? One more beer wouldn't hurt. Come on.
Right.
Yeah. I still fall for that trap.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's the inherent issue, is that all this is ultimately being done on that level, on a language level or a file level, and those things are just like corruptible. You know what I mean? So the confused deputy, you know.
Right. Is it like doing AI red teaming? Is it like doing sort of a traditional red teaming where, look, if I hire a red team, I can work from the basic assumption that they absolutely we always will get in. Like, I don't know if I've ever seen a red team exercise fail. Is it the same thing with LLM, where it's more about the process than just the fact that they can kind of break it?
I've seen a lot. So like some people think that AI red teaming is just like quality assurance. You know what I mean? And then some people think that it's just like harmful output. And then some people think that it's like traditional red teaming. And the fact is I've seen all of those things with like an LLM pen test. You're kind of doing a pen test and everybody knows what you're up to. You have permission, right? This is what you've been contracted to do. But sometimes with an AI red team engagement, it might be, hey, you know, we want you to just basically try to pwn this, but nobody knows but the top level stakeholders, right? Like maybe the CISO, but nobody else knows that you're trying to fly under the radar. So it's not like a pen test in that sense. And it's more like a red team operation in that sense, right? And then there's other instances where you are sort of working for, hey, is this model doing what it's supposed to be doing? So I've had AI red team opportunities where it's like they didn't even put in the rules of engagement that denial of service is off limits. So one of the attacks that we did is it's called token smuggling in machine learning. It's like we took like an emoji and we just packed it full of like a zillion tokens. You know, we call them like token bombs and token grenades. Pliny the Liberator, he basically originally had coded this tool called ParcelTong and open sourced it. And we sort of refined it and kept refining it. So we basically have this, I mean, and anybody can take a look at it. I can link it if it's beneficial, but we can just basically create these like payloads that can do something like that. Now, obviously you don't want to do that. You know, you're not going to be invited back, right? To help out. So, but the idea is like, it can get that wild in AI red teaming where you're literally just shutting down a live environment. You know what I mean? So
I think there's a fair argument that pen testing, red teaming, AI red teaming, adversarial work is fancy QA. Like we give ourselves a lot of credit and bravado for it, but we're testing the security assumptions of an organization, of a scope, and we feel fancier than just a QA person, but to some extent, that's legitimately what it is.
Yeah. I always tell people, like, I work in the validation layer and we just do like testing and evaluations. And so it's like sometimes it's products that are going to go live. Other times it's like systems and subsystems. And other times it's just an AI model or a bot or a drone or something like that. So
yeah, we quiz the scope on an exam it wasn't preparing for. That is a realistic exam of what attackers will do.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's just like, we're just doing like adversarial simulations, right? And that's really what it comes down to, is just like, I'm an ethical hacker. I'm here to help, you know, but I'm going to pretend like I'm the bad guy, you know? So
absolutely agreed.
Yeah.
Awesome. That was super interesting. Thanks for coming in. I think you mentioned at the beginning, I think you said LinkedIn was sort of the best spot. Any other way people can get in touch?
Yeah, LinkedIn is the best way to do it. That's just, you know, I try to do most of my socials through there. And I can share that in the chat if that's all right.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So if you guys know anybody building stuff that needs to be broken and you're looking for people that specialize in emerging technologies, then, you know, there you go.
Very cool. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate the time.
Sure thing. That was great. That was great. So we will see everybody else next week for the next Defender Fridays. All right, have a good weekend.
And that brings us to the end of another Defender Fridays discussion. Support our show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend. Subscribe or give us a rating on whatever podcast platform you're listening from. If you want to be a part of the conversation and join us live, you can register at limacharlie.io/defender-fridays. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you in the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.